This is the Dungeon Master Guys.
Hello and welcome to episode 7 of the Dungeon Master Guys show. I'm Phil, the chatty DM, along with my partners in crime, Dave the Game. Hey, Dave.
Hey.
How you doing, man?
I'm great.
Is your Christmas shopping done?
No, not even close.
But isn't it like Cyber Monday today?
Yeah, but I don't go in for any of that. Oh. I'm a classic procrastinator still.
And I'm also with our other co-host, New BDM. How you doing, man?
How's it going, guys? How are you?
Doing great. You're doing any pre-holiday gaming?
Yeah, I made the mistake of signing back onto Warcraft.
So did I.
And that's the gaming I'm doing.
Oh, it's so worth it.
All right, surrounded.
You're surrounded by WoW whites. All right, so today's a cool show. We've got a discussion with the Gnomes 2 crew. We're going to talk to us about their new book, Eureka. Dave, you also talked with Sarah Dark Magic, right?
I talked to Sarah Dark Magic about if you're a new or inexperienced DM running for players who might be a lot more experienced than you for playing.
That's going to be very interesting. And what about you, newbie?
I am going to talk to you today about ways to encourage your players to do a little more role-playing in your games.
That's always something that we'd like to be more comfortable doing.
Yeah, I got a lot of questions about how to encourage players to do that, so I figured I'd tackle it on the show today.
I'm sure it's going to be very appreciated. Then we'll have a couple of questions from our readers, and that should be today's show.
But first, let's hear from our sponsor, Obsidian Portal.
Too many NPCs to manage? Players can't remember what happened at the last session? Wasting valuable game time flipping through your notebook trying to find some detail you wrote down months ago? Running a tabletop campaign is hard, but Obsidian Portal makes it easy. With Obsidian Portal, you can manage your tabletop RPG campaign online. Our tools let you track NPCs, locations, items, events, and every other detail for your game. Sign up for free at obsidianportal.com and use promo code DMGUYS to get a bonus.
All right, so I got to talk with the Gnomes 2 crew not too long ago about their Eureka GM Guide, which is a many hundreds of campaign ideas and adventure ideas in one book. So why don't we listen to that? It's a very interesting concept. So you recently published a GM-specific book called Eureka, which is filled with campaign and adventure ideas. So, Martin, why don't you tell us about what the product actually is? Aaron, give us the top three reasons why a GM should get it now.
Okay. The full extra-long special title is Eureka 501 Adventure Plots to Inspire Game Masters. So that's what's in it, is 501 complete plots. They kind of walk the middle ground between adventure hooks, which has been done. They're great for their own thing, but they kind of leave a lot of work to you. And fully completed adventures, you know, if you go out and you buy a published module, you don't have to do much work, except when you actually want to shoehorn it into your own game, because everything is so nailed down that, you know, you kind of have to break it apart and put it back together again. So we walk that middle line. You get about half a page. Typically 3 to 5 encounters, so an evening of play, 4 hours easily. You can easily stretch that or compress it if you need to. And it's described one way that things might go, start to finish, twists, notes, anything else like that that you might need. So that 501 we then break down into 167 for three kind of big umbrella genres, for fantasy, for sci-fi, and for horror. And then we throw a huge toolkit together, with each plot having traits that kind of describe the different elements of it. So, you know, if it's really important that the plot take place in some sort of remote area, that's a trait. The plots also have other genres that you can easily adapt them to, usually 5 to 10. So, hey, this is just kind of a supers plot under sci-fi, but it would also really work well with steampunk or in an anime RPG. We call that out for you. So there's indexes at the back of the book that cover everything you might want to look up to kind of enhance your discovery process of finding exactly the plots you need for that particular moment. In terms of three reasons, it's got two huge roles that it can play. One is, oh shit, everybody just showed up and they want to run a game. You know, they want me to run a game for them. I've got nothing, which we've all been in that situation and will be again.
Yeah.
You can flip to any page in the book, run just about any plot in just about any genre. There's no rules. It's all system neutral. So sit down, take 5-10 minutes to sketch things out that you need to based on your group, and you're off. You can run something straight from the book like that. If you had an hour, you could easily stat some things out or pull in monsters from other books and what have you, and have something that your players probably wouldn't know was pulled out of your ass. The second reason is for inspiration. I'm running a weekly game right now, and there's days where I got nothing, but the weekly game is still coming up, and I'll pull out Eureka and just start flipping through it. And it doesn't usually take me very long to find something that I'm like, oh, okay, I don't want to do this, but I'm going to do something like this, and kind of pull things together that way. And then the third reason would be it's so damn huge. I mean, it's a 300-plus page book. It's 501 plots. There's nothing out there quite like it on the market, and our goal was to be definitive. You buy this and you're done. You know, you'll never need to buy another book like this because you've got 10 years worth of plots in one place.
Oh, that's perfect. Then where can you get the book?
All sorts of places. So Engine Publishing is the company that I started to put it out. So enginepublishing.com sells it directly.
Yeah.
I'll pack you up a book and ship it to you by hand or sell you a PDF. The PDFs are available on RPG Now, DriveThruRPG, Paizo.com, E23 shortly. And then we'll be in retail stores in December through our fulfillment partner through Studio 2. So if you walk into your store and say, I want Eureka, and they'll know how to get it.
Very nice. All right. So just to close the show a little bit, I'll have you guys, each of you, tell me a funny or a significant or a cool Eureka story that you lived either through the book or while working on the book. So we'll start with you, John.
All right. There are, you know, I did the art direction for this book as well, and getting the art was excellent. You know,
it's
we
beautiful.
Gave the artists a lot of free rein to give me something that inspires us. A couple of our artists, I mean, every one of them just really came through and gave us really interesting stuff. One of the artists, Andrew McIntosh, who did our cover, he just kept surprising me with what kind of things he gave me. You know, I'd throw him a concept, and he would come back with like, well, I like that, but maybe I'll do it with this. And I'm in the back of my head going, okay, we'll see how this comes through, but if this doesn't work, and whatever he gave me at the end, I was like, wow, that's incredible. I couldn't have found anything better. So I would have to say just the art and the way that it works alongside the plots to inspire people as well is definitely the biggest thing that, you know, I like about my contribution to the book.
Oh, great. So, Phil, what about your story?
So I was the project manager for the book, and so
not surprised.
I was the lead whipcracker on getting the writing done. So to eat my own dog food, I broke down the writing into one plot a day every day. And so I actually did it. I stuck to the schedule, and every day I like woke up in the morning, I grabbed off the list which plot and which genre I was going to work in. On my drive to work, I'd start brainstorming. By lunchtime, I would write down my plot, and that went like clockwork until the last plot.
Wow.
I hit writer's block on the absolute last plot I had to write. And I went the entire day. I could not figure it out. I was stuck completely, and I wound up, I think, until like midnight or so trying to get through that last plot. And in the end, it actually came out okay, but I hated that plot. It was the one plot I absolutely loathed. When the book came out, I was, you know, like I went and peeked at it to see if it was any better than how I remembered it.
All right. Awesome. Thanks. We'll have to wait a little bit because Martin kind of dropped off and he can't come back on. You're back on? Hello?
John and I will speak for Martin.
Yeah,
Martin loved editing, right, John?
Oh, I say Martin loved editing, absolutely. We would call him and want to talk about plots, and he would just be, I can't, I'm editing.
No, the idea is to get Martin, we'll get you really riled up, and you'll start swearing your funny story part.
Sorry about that. I must be something on my end. I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
Yeah, it's no, I'm going to shut up.
You're
just too far away.
I am on the Rock Band mic, but I've done podcasts with this before, and it works great.
Well, you see, what you don't know, Martin, was I use star power over here to bring you back.
That's going to be a great outtake. So I'm just going to switch the question over to you, Martin, and then we'll go to what's next to each of you, and we'll finish the show.
So what, I missed the end of
the show. Don't worry. I'll do the lead-in. So what about you, Martin? You were the head editor of that project, and you are probably, I think you were the, you created or you had the idea first. What was your favorite funny or painful or definitive Eureka story?
You know, I've been racking my brain while I listened to John and Phil, who came up with really great things really quickly. And I was so involved in it for a year. I mean, it took a year to produce. I don't know if I could pull one thing out of it. There was a few big surprises. The first one probably being, you know, once the work caught up with my fevered original idea and we realized just how much was involved and just how long it was going to take, it really kind of took on a new life of its own and, sort of ran my life for the next few months.
Yes.
That's not a great answer, but I lived it for too long to be able to pull one thing out of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I remember when you were working on it and you had reached that this project sucked point, and there was no turning back. It was just that huge. But okay, so let's just change this in a little question. Is you've got a lot of listeners that will want to publish their own RPG book one day. What's your first huge lesson you got from that?
Okay, yeah, that's an easy one. So I post some of these little nuggets of pseudo wisdom on the Engine Publishing blog rather than on Gnome Stew, since they're publishing specific. Absolutely, far and away, the biggest thing that I learned was that everything will take longer than you think it will. We planned it for about a 6-month project, and it was a year. And I think when we do the next book, it will be, we're planning it for 6 months and hoping it'll take 9.
All right.
You know, so take everything we learned and it'll still probably take longer than we think. It's just, there's too many moving parts to do that the first time and not have things take much longer than you think it will.
All right. That's awesome. All right, guys. Let's finish the show, let's finish this segment with one little short thing. Why don't you tell me what's next for you guys? Either your next game or your next project that you can talk about or whatever teaser that you like to share. Phil?
Next game, I'm always playing something. So my next set of articles, I'm really trying to focus on lightening up prep, boiling what you need to prep down to the absolute essentials and starting to shift to ad-libbing the rest. So from prep heavy to prep light.
Nice. Martin?
And I want Phil to write those faster because I'm using that in how I'm running my game right now, and I love it.
Very good. So you have a deadline, Phil. So, Martin, what's next?
We're going to start working on another book in the next couple of weeks here. Shoot for having it out around Gen Con next year in 2011.
And
still totally under wraps. I know that's the next thing you're going to ask.
God damn.
But it'll be a little ways out before we start talking about it. I don't like to talk about things before they're
fair enough.
So but certain that they have all the momentum they need.
All right. So, but you're excited about it?
Oh, yeah.
All right. And you've got a crack team of odd people that you trust that, you know, will do awesome job on it?
Yeah. All of the authors and designers, which is the gnomes who worked on Eureka, are working on it. We'll bring back artists, editors, other folks that we worked with, and then it's more ambitious in some ways, so we'll probably wind up roping in several other people that we don't know about yet.
Then reserve me a copy, and I'll pick a paper copy of both Eureka and that book at Gen Con.
Excellent.
All right, awesome. All right, John, what about you? What's next, or what's happening right now?
Well, I actually just finished releasing. Martin said, you know, everything will take longer than you think. That is absolutely true. I actually just finished releasing an RPG called Silvervine Games, which started about 7 years ago as an I don't have anything to do right now project. Mm-hmm. Might as well start working on something. It, like you said about Martin, it kind of got to that point where I was ready to drop it so many times, but it was at the point where I just couldn't let it go, you know, until it was good enough to be out there. So we just finished it back in September, got our first print run, took it to a small convention in October, and sold out of all but 10 copies of it.
It's very nice.
So, yeah, I won't give the spiel or anything, but go check out SilvervineGames.com if you want to know more about it.
Well, I remember seeing an earlier copy of the game when you sent me a review copy, and it was really interesting.
Yeah, back when it was – interesting is a good word for it back then.
Well, I can't wait to play it with you, man.
I'll be happy to. I'll come up to Canada and do it there.
Boy, I actually might invite you to a con in Montreal. So, guys, thank you very much for showing up. It was nice to tell our listeners a little bit more about Gnomes Tooth for those who didn't know about it, or learn a little bit more about what you did, what you liked, or what you're going to work on for those who actually know about it. So – once again, thank you very much for being guests on the Dungeon Master Guys show, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Talk to you later, guys.
Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
The Eureka book is completely awesome, and I can't wait to see whatever the Gnomes 2 guys do next. So, guys, did you have a look at the book?
Yeah, I had a chance to read the book. They sent me a review copy. I reviewed it for the site. I thought the book was great. I love the way they broke it down. I love the way they all the articles have tags on them at the end, so you can sort of, if you're searching for something, you could find it easily. If you're searching for a specific adventure seed or anything like that, it's a well put together book. I got to give them credit for being their first book. I thought it was pretty fantastic.
The tags idea is great. It's simple, and it binds together all different themes that you can use the ideas for.
Yeah.
So I'm so going to use it when I'm fishing for ideas, that's for sure.
Yeah, it was ahead of Gen Con. They sold out pretty quickly. I got a PDF early copy, but I really wanted the printed thing, and it was just gone.
It's on top of my list for next Gen Con. So what about you, Dave?
Well, I talked to Sarah Dark Magic, whose real name is actually Tracy. She is something of a new DM, having only started in the past year and a half. She talks a little bit in the interview about how she got started, but the interesting thing about her group is that, you know, it's not all players getting into it at the same time. Her group was already pretty experienced with D&D, and she stepped into the DM's role, and so I talked to her a bit about that and what it's like to plunge into a group who, you know, has grown up on D&D and what it's like to run for them.
All right, so let's listen to that.
Tell us about the famous Sarah Dark Magic. How did you get your start in DMing? How long have you been doing it? What's your campaign like? All that stuff.
Okay, well, I started playing D&D about a year and a half ago. We've been hosting for a few years my husband's gaming group. And for some reason, I started listening to the podcast that Wizards released with Penny Arcade and PvP and said, you know, they need another player. This sounds like it could be fun. Why don't I give it a shot and, you know, make my husband's night? So that's what I did. And that's how I got started. Cool. And Sarah Dark Magic is the name of my first character. So.
And that shows the roots from the podcast right there. So how'd you make the transition from player to Dungeon Master?
Well, the big thing actually that happened when I listened to the podcast is I really wanted to run the game, but I didn't want to say that right away. But they kind of guessed pretty quickly. And then the perfect opportunity came. My brother was going to visit for a weekend, and he's a big second edition person. And I didn't want anybody else to have to DM for him, so I said I would do it. And that's how I got started. I ran the first level Dungeon Delve from the book. Mm-hmm. For the group, just to get my feet wet, and then I tried to run one for my brother and his friend and the rest of the group later on, and that was the beginning.
So you were running with a group that had been together for a while and been playing for a while and so had a bit more experience. Did you run into any challenges specifically with that?
I think in some ways it's hard to sometimes talk about this to people who've played for a while because they sometimes don't realize the assumptions that they're making when they play. And so when you have someone come in, I had been around the game for my whole life, but I didn't really play and I didn't read the books and I didn't read any of the novels. So there was a lot of quick learning I had to do to get it so that we all were on the same page when we were playing the game. Mm-hmm. That was one of the big ones. The other one is just, you know, sometimes it's hard when you don't know the rules as well, or you don't know the history of the rules as well, and you try to make a judgment and somebody calls you on it to be like, no, that's, you're just going to listen to me because I'm somehow better than you.
Right.
That can also get to be a little problematic.
It's a problem no matter what group of gamers you're dealing with, though.
Right, yeah. But one of the interesting things was I had a lot of assumptions about what type of game they wanted to play because we had been playing Keep on the Shadowfell, which had a lot of combat, and the part I had seen, like, they just wanted to get through the combat and get it done with, which meant I thought that that's what they wanted out of the game, and they pretty quickly taught me otherwise. Mm-hmm. You know, I had set up an encounter where there's going to be basically this mob in the middle of the town, and they're going to get attacked, and they're like, well, we want to talk to them instead. I was like, okay, sure, we could talk. What do we want to talk about?
Right.
But it was great being able to just pull out a skill challenge for that and, you know, having enough confidence in myself, even though I didn't have confidence in myself in the game sense, but knowing that, you know what, we're just going to have fun with this, and I think I can come up with something and just roll with it, really helped.
So you're able to kind of turn that around, which is something that even experienced DMs have trouble with sometimes, taking that scene that you expected to go one way and then have to completely reorient how you're thinking about it.
Right. Yeah.
What was some of the stuff that the group kind of took for granted that everybody knew that you weren't quite, you know, in the know on that they expected you to be?
Well, so the very first session I ran in my game world, which was Noomshire, I pulled out of DDI, there's some pre-adventure thing for Keep of the Shadowfell, mm-hmm. where it's a graveyard. And I said, you know what, this would be a good, let them see how their characters work before I throw a real monster group at them. Because, you know, there's always a little concern, at least for me when I was starting out, because I knew that older editions, it was very easy to kill characters, and I didn't want to kill someone my first night.
Right.
I wanted something easier for them. They can work out how their characters are working and everything. And I threw that up at them, and their immediate question was, you know, this shrine, who is it to, which god is it to? And, you know, I picked some god, and they automatically assumed that that meant something important.
Okay.
So they're instantly rolling dice, history and religion checks and everything. And I'm just like, I don't know, guys.
Right.
I think some of the older players, or not older players, but people who've played for a while assume that whenever a DM says something, it means something. And they want to try to figure that out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes with newer players, or at least with me, I didn't know that they were going to do that. So that was kind of scary at first.
Yeah, again, that seems, I mean, it makes total sense. But at the same time, it's stuff I still run into where, you know, I'll pull out, well, it's related to this god, or even kind of weird details that aren't quite as heavily loaded, like, you know, that the door is made of a certain material or something, that people will jump to these big conclusions like, oh, you must have put it here because, you know, because of this whole, like, thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's the fact that this door is a different material than the other doors is significant, even though it's just like, oh, I just forgot what kind of door it was.
Right. And then on top of it, you know, for me, I had no idea I just picked a god's name because it fit enough, but I didn't know everything about the cosmology of the universe at this point. I'd only been playing for 3 months, and I'd been concentrating on a lot of other stuff. And so to try to give it meaning was really hard. Mm-hmm. Now that now that I've been playing a while, and thanks to people like you and Mike Shea and Newbie and Chatty, I've learned a ton. I can now try to transition it into the story and make it make sense in the big world, where at that time I couldn't.
Right. Those points can be tough the first time you get called on something that you can't really explain, you know, because there are, especially among established players, there's this whole, you know, like the DM knows everything attitude.
Right.
And that can be tough to kind of take on that role even.
Yeah, well, it happened a few weeks later that I'd picked the dog, the very hungry dog, and they're like, well, why is the dog so hungry? So I was like, oh, well, you know, they don't have a lot of money and they haven't been feeding it. But so they went and they're like, that's it. We have to take down this owner of this dog because it's terrible the way they're treating it. And they go there and they defeat them. And of course you're supposed to give treasure every so often. So I gave treasure, and they're like, well, wait, why is there treasure here if they don't have any money? I was like, well, it just came in.
The check was in the mail. And you intercepted it, yeah.
And I felt so stupid afterwards, but that's all in the game, and you learn from it.
Sure, and that's something that could be spun in, like, well, why did he have money, you know, and kind of
right.
Like, oh, maybe you can answer this question for me because I haven't really thought about it.
Right. Yeah, that's probably what I would do now. I really like making them come up with the stories. And then, you know, when I see them making a lot of checks, try to react to it, even if I hadn't planned something. Like, you know, if they decide to go into somebody's house and they're constantly making perception checks, that's when I throw a mimic at them.
Right.
Because they want it. You know they want it.
Right. You've been looking for trouble and now you found it.
There you go. Ta-da!
So, do you have any last advice on someone who's new to DMing but is going to be running for more experienced players? Just one big, you know, if you could go back in time and tell yourself something sort of advice?
Well, you know, obviously, they're probably going to know that you're new. Like, you've probably already told them, but I would definitely tell them that you're new. And what that means is your world may be a little different than the way that they might expect it, so always ask questions. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, don't feel like you have to know everything. And if you're comfortable improvising, that's going to be really a lot of fun to do if you let yourself do it. And you're going to make mistakes. You're going to forget monster powers. You're totally going to forget that they might not want to fight the mob, and that's okay. And the world pauses as the DM thinks. Is what my friend said in college, and it's still true today. If you have to take that pause, just do it.
Yep, makes sense. I'd say that's good advice for DMs, no matter how experienced you are. Well, Tracy, thank you for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you.
I've got the chance to meet Tracy at PAX last year, and I got to tell you that she's a very good GM. She listens to what the player do around the table. She's very in touch with with the whole table mood, and she shows great promise. I can't wait to actually play at one of her games in a con.
Yeah, same here. She's still holding it against me that I beat her in the DM challenge, so she really wants a rematch.
Well, she's got to beat you and me.
Of course.
I sat with her at this past JetCon while she was DMing the Red Box adventure in the ballroom, and yeah. she did a great job, and her website's really good too. I've always thought that her website, if NoobieDM.com is a spiritual successor, it would be SarahDarkMagic.com, because we both sort of write from the same perspective of new DMs. And if anyone out there hasn't seen her website, SarahDarkMagic.com, it's a pretty cool site.
Knowing her, we just made her weak. All right, Newbie, what about you? What's cooking in your own segment?
What's cooking is role playing, and
All right. I
find I get a lot of questions sent to me about encouraging players to role play more and to find ways to bring players out of their shell, especially newer players, and encourage them to embrace that side of role playing games, which is one of the most important parts of the game, is the role-playing. And I figured I'd throw some tips out there for DMs to use at their games to encourage it. So why don't we take a listen?
All right.
One of the things I find that most gives new gaming groups problems are finding and encouraging ways to make role-playing part of the table experience. And 4th edition, which is designed with a big slant towards combat, seems to also be a source of concern for groups, if what I read on forum groups and emails that I've received are to be believed. Of course, there's absolutely no reason why role-playing can't be a part of your game, so I'm going to give you some ideas that have worked well in my game and have led to some good role-playing opportunities. I'll start with morality. I quickly found that moral conundrums lead to great player interaction and role-playing. There's a fine balance you must keep if you're going to do this, though, because players will often have differing views of what's right versus what's wrong, and you want to avoid this leading to an inter-party conflict at the table, where it becomes destructive to your game and an all-around bad time for everybody. One of the situations I used involved the sidetrack I designed around Keep on the Shadowfell back when I was running it. The party entered a crypt, they defeated some hobgoblins, they found a magical dagger inside one of the coffins in the crypt, and the rogue decided that he was going to take it, while the cleric felt that he was desecrating a grave and he shouldn't take the magical item. It led to minutes worth of role playing at the table. It was very enjoyable for all, and the players really got into it. Another situation that came up in my game involved a minor NPC I created as a MacGuffin to the storyline. She was a child that was being hunted by Shattered Kai and had powers that controlled the weather. And the PCs were ordered by the council that was sending them on missions to find this girl and bring her to them. And the party questioned the council's motives and were feeling a bit wrong about having to bring a girl to the council without really knowing what was going to happen to her or not. They didn't like the uncertainty of the fate of the girl. And it led to good role-playing because it capitalized on players' emotions and their views on certain issues. Another time involved placing a group of ogres in an encounter, and the encounter involved ogre children, and the players questioned amongst themselves whether or not they should attack these children, even though they were ogres. And it led to them getting into character and thinking how their characters would feel and stuff like that, which I found very, very rewarding as a DM that I was able to make that come out in the game. Another thing you could do is question their honor. Characters, and particularly Dragonborn and Dwarves, are really big on honor. And this is something you can use to your advantage. You have to learn which buttons you can push on them, as sometimes the simple insinuation that they're being somehow dishonorable will lead them to defending their actions and their methods. Investigative work. If you set up a situation in your game that leads to investigation, keep it from becoming an exercise in die rolling and checking against the DC. If a player says, "I'm making my streetwise," ask him exactly what he's asking or telling the barkeep at the tavern. Play up the conversation, asking for roles that may or may not mean anything. You might want to keep him guessing. And determine where the conversation will go from there. I found that PCs that give off bad attitudes or ask for coin in exchange for info provide great role-playing moments. People don't like random strangers asking them random questions out of the blue. So remember that next time the party goes around investigating. Use that to draw out the player characters. And finally, role-playing during a battle is also a possibility. Always remember that intelligent creatures are not very keen on death, and at some point may give up fighting to try and save their hides. 8 bugbears may be tough when encountered, but when it's down to 1 bugbear and his Morningstar, he may have a different view of the situation. You might want to use that to encourage role-play sessions between the monsters that they're fighting and the PCs. So while these aren't the only ways you can get your group to roleplay more, they're easy situations to introduce in your game. Don't be discouraged if you're a new DM with new players, because the roleplay will come in time. Also keep in mind that, as one of the books somewhere says, this isn't an exercise in improvisational theater. You need to learn to create a fine balance between dropping the dice to roleplay and just killing things and taking their stuff. Either way, the most important thing is to have a good time, no matter what your group's playstyle is. Let's go back now with Phil and Dave.
All right, newbie, that was very interesting. The thing that always surprises me when we talked about role-playing is that while we give people advice on role-playing, we have our own ideas about role-playing, we rarely sit around the table and discuss what is our own definition of role-playing. And just look at the hundreds of RPG blogs and you see that it's different. So I'm kind of curious, what do you guys define in a few short words? What do you mean by role-playing?
I tend to think of games, and I'm a big fan of movies and theater and drama. So I tend to think of games, role-playing games, as a way of exercising or maybe recreating that at the table while you're playing. So I tend to see them kind of a lot of people ask, do you play in first person or third person? We tend to play in first person at my table because that's the kind of games I like. I like the players becoming characters, so I see role-playing as taking on the persona of an actual character at the table and speaking as that character and speaking in character. That's the type of game I like when I play and when I DM, and that's how I see role-playing.
All right, cool. Dave?
I kind of see it as a spectrum almost. I mean, there are some kind of fuzzy labels out there, but you've got sort of the game aspect, you know, of role-playing games is one of it. And then you've got the sort of the role-playing aspect to it, which is, you know, you are taking on the role of a character, you know, like you're doing the first person talking, you're saying, what would this character do in this situation? And then you sort of have the story aspect of it where, you know, it's not necessarily you're talking character all the time, but you're working on building a story together. And a lot of games sort of operate, you know, on that continuum, and people have different preferences and whatnot. And so the role playing, like if you want to get really specific on those words, to me it's, you know, focusing on what your character, you know, how it interprets everything going on. But there are all these other parts to it that tend to be part of the games we play.
Yeah. Role-playing is just something that I actually started really thinking about in terms of what it is when I started writing on the net about it. But, I mean, around my gaming table, and that hasn't changed much, is just really whatever happens, whatever. I'm very focused on my players' emotions. I like to, you know, play on that and manipulate that to a certain level. So for me, role-playing game is just the amount of activity that the players invest themselves around the table. So it can be mechanic, or it can be very, very, very deeply emotional or story oriented. And I just, you know, go with the flow. But it's kind of, I think it's important for a group to discuss how to define role playing and to also all agree that it doesn't have to be the same way for everyone around the table.
I think a lot of it is DMs and players hashing out their expectations of the game before you start playing, and making sure everybody's comfortable with whatever level of roleplay you decide your game is going to be.
Yeah, but that being said, depending on how you define the role-playing game, then you can use different tips like the ones you just gave to make the experience better.
Yeah, so this past weekend I had one of these kind of interesting, tough choices that kind of came in as a result of the story, where I was testing my, I'm calling it the Gamerizer way that, you know.
Which is Will Wheaton approved, man.
Yes, it is now, yep. A way of kind of taking your hometown or some other location that all the players are familiar with, and sort of cooperatively you all toss in elements of that setting and then change them to be kind of Gamerworld-y. So I was running a playtest of that this past weekend. And one of the players was actually the girlfriend of Rights on the Site is the main event. And it was her first time playing any kind of role-playing game whatsoever. She wanted to see what all the fuss was about, you know, and we figured Gamerworld would be a pretty decent one to jump into. And so as part of the game, you know, I had everyone write down, you know, like they had a location, and then somehow it ties into one of their two mutant origins. And she was like part plant, and so she wrote that like the park, you know, was filled with these plant monsters that will become her army. And so during the last fight, when they finally encountered these plant monsters that she had written on the card about, she tried to negotiate with them, and they said, well, they're not going to stop what they're doing, but they invite you to join them, and they'll be your army afterwards. And so she had to. She started to think in character, like, "Oh man, you know, I really wanted this plant army, but they're doing something bad." And you know, other players were kind of weighing in on the whole situation. And ultimately, she decided to stick with the party. But we went out to dinner afterwards, and she was like, "Huh, it probably would have been more interesting had I joined the plant monsters."
Nice.
To me, that's, you know, like I'm perfectly happy with how the game went, and I'm sure, we all too, but it had her thinking, you know, even after the game.
Oh, those what-if moments are great.
Yep.
Oh, nice. Awesome. All right, cool. That completes our segment section of the show. Let's move on to the questions. I think we got two questions this month.
Yes. Harvey says that he is planning a very ambitious campaign for Forgotten Realms that involves psychic characters in a realm of nightmares that are trying to escape into the physical realm by shattering the barrier through the denizens of Faerun's dreams. hitting a bit of a snag, though, since there isn't exactly any good references to use when it comes to a Nightmare Air realm. So he's asking if we have any pointers or suggestions that he could use kind of as a springboard for these ideas.
Yeah, you know, one of the reasons why a lot of the stuff that we want to do, very ambitious stuff we want to do for our campaigns, there's not a lot of material for it. It's because it is so ambitious and it's very, very specific in terms of campaign scope. So you pretty much have to do it all on your own. I'd say that if he wants to do something about the Nightmare Realm and he wants to have psychic characters and be focused on that, I think he should basically start start small. Just create this one adventure with a very strong nightmarish theme, not create too many mechanics with him, and maybe just create a psionic-only party and just check how his players react to that and just work from there.
I tried to be ambitious at the start, and it didn't work out for me personally. So if he's a new DM, I would recommend he keep that in the back of his mind, but start small and work his way up.
And if he's experienced, he could start deeper, but very much check how his players react to the actual campaign before spending too much effort creating more stuff.
Yeah,
and even if he is an experienced DM, you know, we've all tried to run very specific kind of theme campaigns and had them work to one extent or another, and still starting small no matter what and kind of working off what your players are contributing and what you want to get out of it as you go instead of trying to put it all out there once is, I think, it's good advice no matter what experience level you have. Plus, for something like this where you've got, you know, this Nightmare Realm psychic stuff that you're going to focus on, I also recommend saying to yourself, okay, where did this come from? Why am I interested in this? You know, what sources am I drawing from? And then just going to those sources and steal. You know, like if this were my campaign, I'd go into Lovecraft. I'd go into whatever other, it's probably some Stephen King stuff that's kind of similar, and just lift whatever you can directly and, you know, see what sticks.
And if he plays D&D 4E, I just reapply it over, you know, existing powers and classes, existing monster types, refluffing the whole thing without reinventing the wheel.
Yep.
All right, cool. Doobie, we had a phone message from one of our readers, right?
Yeah, we got a voicemail coming to the hotline asking about writing dialogue. Why don't we listen to it?
Hi, this is Stark in Seattle, and I've got a question for the DM guys. I have trouble writing dialogue for my group, and I was wondering if you guys had any tips or tricks for writing good dialogue for things like skill challenges or mission briefs or quest lines even. If you guys could answer that for me, that would be wonderful. Thanks.
So there you go, guys. He wants to know how to write better dialogue for his adventures, be it I think he's talking maybe about flavor text because he mentioned skill challenges and quests and stuff like that. So we could tackle both. We could talk about writing good dialogue and writing good flavor text.
Yeah, well, dialogue is a confusing word, and let's just say that's what he meant, because he probably wanted to have, you know, powerful sounding pieces of text that would hold his player's interest. So I'll assume that's what he meant. And it's kind of hard, because a dialogue by definition is something that you have at least two parties participating in. And it's kind of hard because you don't know what the other parties are going to say. So in such cases, I would focus on writing speaking points on cards for your quests, for your quest givers, for your skill challenge steps, and more or less capture in your speaking points. Keep them short, Twitter size, basically, but put the power words in them and just improvise from there. I know improv is hard. I know improv is scary. I've spent the last year exploring what it is, but it's a skill. You do get better with it, but you need to try.
I'm a big fan of two things. One, you got to do a lot of reading. The more you read, the better you get at recognizing what good dialogue is and what good writing is all about. But two, I think a lot of times you could be helped. You can help yourself by reading books about screenwriting. Believe it or not, because screenwriting teaches you how to write good dialogue and how to write concise and precise dialogue that gets to the point quickly, because in screenwriting, the whole point is to make scenes as short as possible while maintaining the biggest impact possible. There's not a lot of wasted space in a script. There's not a lot of stuff that shouldn't be in a script. They're very precise as to how they write and what they write. So if you want to write dialogue that gets to the point quickly, which I'm not doing right now. If you want to write dialogue that gets to the point quickly, you might want to pick up a screenwriting book because it'll teach you how to do it and how to do it well. I'm a big fan of screenwriting books.
I am too, although I've never applied them towards DMing. I loved Bambi versus Godzilla, although they're probably, even though David Mamet's writing it, it doesn't really talk about dialogue a lot. But at the same time, also realize, you know, for your home games, you're not necessarily writing the stuff to be published. So people aren't going to know if you didn't have everything written out ahead of time. I like the idea of, you know, little bullet points that say, here are the things that I want to cover, and it can come up sort of naturally in the conversation. Plus, the more you rely upon big blocks of text, the less it does actually become a dialogue between you and your players. It's more you talking at them for a long period of time, in which case they have time to like zone out and whatnot. But, you know, if you've got them more broken up, you can like throw something at them and then they can come back and, you know, you might have the answers written in front of you, but instead of doing a whole block at a time, you know, you're doing a little bit, getting player reactions, you know, and taking their questions and feeding back into it.
Exactly. All right, well, this concludes our 7th Dungeon Master Guys show. I hope you appreciated it. We are always having a lot of fun doing it, and we hope we plan to do it for quite a long time. In the meantime, don't forget, we really like your questions. Don't forget to email us at
dmg@critical-hits.com.
And don't forget to call into the voicemail line at 305-349-3026.
All right, and I want to thank our sponsors, ObsidianPortal.com, for supporting this show. This has been Phil the Chatty DM, Dave the Game Shocker, and Newbie DM signing off.